And welcome to our session this afternoon on China and the environment. I want to thank DHL for sponsoring this and all the other parts of the China track. The issue of China and its environment is something that's obviously gotten a lot greater public attention in recent years. And one only needs to look at some of the headlines in recent weeks and months to realize how important this has become in the international dialogue. We've all read about the massive toxic benzene spill in the Songhua River that cut off water to one of China's largest cities for days in 2005. WHO has said that 7 of the 10 of the most polluted cities in the world are in China. By some reckonings, just today, China surpassed the United States as the largest emitter of CO2, but by whatever metric you want to use, it's either today or tomorrow, or at least in the next year or so. We know that environment is having a big impact on China's economy. Some have estimated that environmental costs reduce GDP growth by as much as 10% annually. We know that it's had an impact in terms of the problem of water, and we're going to have a chance to talk about that, with 2 out of 3 Chinese cities with not enough water to meet their needs and 100 facing severe shortage. And it's also having an impact on Chinese society, with China's own authorities reporting 50,000 environmental-related protests in 2005. And so there's a lot to be concerned about, a lot to be interested in, to understand more deeply, to get behind the headlines, and to understand better just what these challenges are, what China's doing about it, and what we can do. And those are the 3 topics that our panel is going to focus on today. First, just what is going on? What are the big environmental challenges in China, and how is the Chinese government approaching them? Second, what are the broader implications of these environmental problems for Chinese society, for its economy, for its political system, for its governance? And finally, how should the rest of the international community, the United States, international organizations, work with China or deal with China in trying to address these problems? And we have an extraordinary panel today to talk about these issues with extensive experience on the topics. First, Bruce Babbitt, known to many of you, almost all of you here, former Secretary of the Interior, who is now chairman of the World Wildlife Fund, WWF, in the United States and has been extensively involved in China. David Dollar, who's the director for the World Bank of their China office right now in Beijing, and a former director for development policy at the World Bank. Peter Gleick, as you can tell, they're not in order, Bruce in the middle, David at the far left, Peter Gleick between the two of them, who's the president of the Pacific Institute in Oakland, the founder of the Pacific Institute, a MacArthur Fellow and a member of the National Academy of Sciences, one of the world's leading authorities on water. Orville Schell, known to all of you, is one of the premier observers, commentators on China, and equally important, a dean. We like to have lots of deans on these panels, the dean of the Berkeley School of Journalism. And finally, He Fan, who was supposed to be with us today, was unfortunately unable to join us. We've been very fortunate that Jia Feng has been willing to participate in this panel. He is the deputy director of the Center for Environmental Education and Communication at SEPA, the State Environmental Protection Agency in China, and so can give us a perspective from the inside on some of these big issues. So I'm going to start by asking the panelists briefly in 3 minutes or so to talk about what they see as the biggest environmental challenge in China today and how the Chinese government and society is beginning to cope with it. And we're going to go alphabetically, so I'll begin with Bruce.
Jim, thank you. I would like to use my 3 minutes to just reflect briefly on the experience that WWF has had as an NGO in China. We began in China 26 years ago and have had we were the first ones in. I think, I don't know whether it related to the fact that by pure coincidence, our logo is the panda. But for whatever reason, we were there 26 years ago and now have a continuing and substantial presence. Out of that experience, I would make 3 brief points. First of all, the Chinese government has come a long way in the recognition of the importance of these environmental issues. Secondly, they have had some real success. The one example that I think is justly and most widely commented on is the forest policy issues. The government began responding to these after these horrendous floods on the Yangtze River in the 1990s. traceable and clearly in some measure to the massive deforestation as a result of the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution. Now, the government in the last 10 years has responded quite forcefully in the Upper Yangtze. First of all, by decree, they simply ended logging in some 18 provinces in the Upper Yangtze River. Secondly, there's been a massive reforestation program now underway in Outer Mongolia as a result of the desertification. In the upper reaches of the Yangtze River, I spent a week looking at the reforestation projects in the Minshan Mountains last week. They have moved the level of forest cover in China from a low of about maybe perhaps around 10%, clear up above 15% with a stated goal of 20% in the next five-year plan. The reforestation is, it's not perfect. It tends to be plantation style, monocultures, variety of other problems, but it's a major achievement for which the government deserves credit. The other side of the coin, which I would lay out quickly, is the pollution problem. If they've been successful in some measure on the green side, there's been very little success on the brown side. And the reason, I think, is this. When it comes to resource policy and reforestation, the command and control tradition works very well. The government says we're going to reforest. Anybody who's caught chopping down trees will be executed. And it works. The difficulty with pollution, don't you see, is it's wrapped up in the industrialization process. And paradoxically, the industrialization and the economic growth has been achieved precisely because the government has abdicated and yielded control to the provinces and the local governments, effectively stepping back. Pollution control is not going to be addressed until the government finds some way of getting back into the economic system from which it has retreated, because the pollution is so intimately involved in the very success story. That, to me, is the major dilemma in this country today, because the subsidiariness of government, the administrative systems, the ability to control all of these local governments running wild in this economic boom, has atrophied whatever there was in the way of the ability to set up modern administrative and civil society systems which are absolutely essential to the control of air and water pollution. I'll stop there because I hope that we will come back to that question, because I see it as the central environmental issue that has not been dealt with and for which we desperately need some clarity and progress.
I do hope we can come back to that, and I'm hoping we can get Jeff Hung to say a little bit from his perspective. David, what do you see as the biggest challenge?
Okay, thank you. I'm very happy to be here. I often argue that environmental degradation is the single biggest challenge that China faces, so I'm very happy to be on this panel. I think the environmental problems, I would list three in particular. China is a very water-scarce country, and it has very serious water pollution problems. China also has very serious air pollution problems. That's the second environmental issue. It has 20 of the 30 most air-polluted cities in the world. This has very serious health costs in terms of excess mortality, premature mortality and excess morbidity. Now, the air pollution traditionally came from burning a lot of coal in homes and in factories and in power stations, and many cities have moved away from the use of coal, but ironically, just as that's happening, the same cities are now getting very rapid motorization, so you have tremendous growth in the vehicle fleet, and now you have emissions from vehicles becoming a major source of air pollution. The third issue is that China has emerged as the largest emitter of greenhouse gases. We can argue about whether it exactly happened today, but very soon China will clearly be the largest emitter of greenhouse gases. China is likely to be a big loser from global warming. So this is an important environmental issue that will affect China, and China is a major source of this. Now, I agree very much with Bruce Babbitt's point that China got into this mess by growing extremely rapidly and paying very little attention to environmental protection, and starting out as a very poor country. There's some logic in that approach. But now you've got a middle class developing, people's incomes are rising, and I think attitudes towards the environment are changing. So the main point I want to make in my three-minute opening is that I think in the last few years, there's really a new atmosphere about environmental issues in China. And we see this at different levels and in different ways. So let me just give a couple of quick examples. In preparing its new five-year plan, the city of Beijing took the unprecedented step of actually polling its citizens about what they wanted in the five-year plan. And for those of us who live in Beijing, it was no surprise that people overwhelmingly picked air pollution and traffic congestion as the two biggest issues they wanted the government to move on. In this nationwide five-year plan, there are very ambitious environmental targets, increase energy efficiency, which would have environmental impact in a positive way, reduce pollution. So I think we see awareness at a high level. I just saw a quote from Vice Minister Pan Yue of Environmental Protection Agency yesterday, which was so striking. I just have to read this one sentence. Vice Minister of Environment says, "Traditional ways of development have caused the near breakdown of China's resources and environment, and people's lives are in great danger." So this is quite striking that senior officials are making these kind of statements. Now, I very much agree with another point Bruce Babbitt made. Unfortunately, for better or for worse, China is not a country where the top leadership can just send the word down the line to clean up the environment and people fall into place. I think there's a lot of misconceptions about China. It's a very decentralized system in which the central authorities do not really have that much control. So the last couple examples of the changing environment I want to cite are ones at a more local level. Traditionally, we've seen a lot of competition among Chinese cities. And this has been competition initially to attract investment, often to attract very polluting factories. But in the last few years, I've seen a change where more and more cities are competing to get the label of a green city with a good environment. I think what's happening is that many southern cities in China have reached a stage of development where their next step is to compete with Silicon Valley. You know, they want to attract R&D, they want high-tech production, and they realize that a good quality of life is part of a competitive environment once you start competing in that sphere. So you've got cities like Hangzhou and Suzhou or Qingdao and Shandong province, which are making very concrete efforts to clean up the brown side. So the one small disagreement I have with Bruce is I think there are quite a few cities where we actually see improvement in water quality and we actually see reductions in air pollution. So we do see progress at the local level in some cities in China, and I think that competition among cities is quite encouraging. The last point I would make is at the very grassroots level, it's most encouraging that we see a lot of genuine NGOs developing. There are more Chinese NGOs in the environmental area, in my view, than in any other sphere. And I think this may be that the central government is tolerating the growth of environmental NGOs because they are concerned about the issue and they feel that they don't have instruments, and local activism is one potential instrument to address this issue. So I think the rise of environmental NGOs is a very positive development in China that potentially can drive progress. So my basic point is very serious environmental problems, but a changed atmosphere in the past few years that gives me hope that real progress can be made. Thank you.
Peter?
Yes, thank you. I'm going to talk about three things very briefly. I believe, first of all, that water is a very serious problem in China. Now, I say that in part because I know a little bit about water, and I don't know that much about air pollution. But I do believe that water is a critical, hard to say the critical, environmental issue in China. But without a doubt, it's a major factor, as it is in many other parts of the world. I'll come back to that. The second point is that solutions to water problems are taking two different paths. And they're taking two different paths in China, and they're taking two different paths in the rest of the world as well. And there's a little bit of schizophrenia going on about how to solve those water problems. And I'll talk about the two paths. And the third is that water is not just an environmental issue, but as David said, and as Bruce Babbitt said, it's a political issue. There are political and economic overtones to these water problems. And I think that has ramifications in China that we don't fully understand, the Chinese don't fully understand, and they have ramifications in the rest of the world that we don't fully understand. So the first one, water. Water is a big issue. It's a metaphor in many ways for other resources. A lot of the things that I'm going to say about water, we could say about energy, we could say about forests, we could say about soils and agriculture. Water is overused. It's underregulated. When it is regulated, it's underenforced. Those regulations tend to be underenforced. It's misallocated among users. It's often very heavily contaminated. China, yes, all of those problems. Much of the rest of the world, yes, many of those problems. So the kinds of things we see going on in China are not unique to China, although the severity of the problems we see in China with water are, I think, especially acute. 20% of the world's population, 7% of the world's water. And the water that China gets is badly distributed. Nature provides a lot more water in southern China than in northern China, and so northern China has very serious water constraints, especially around Beijing and the North China Plains. So badly distributed in both space and time. There was a little mention of the Harbin water contamination incident, where the water system of Harbin was shut down for 5 or 6 days because of a benzene spill. I think it was benzene. That turned into an international incident because that river is an international river. It's shared by not just China, but Russia. And when that contaminant flowed across the border, all of a sudden Russia had a contamination problem. Again, a metaphor for many, many of the water problems we see. And when I saw that contamination incident, I thought, well, you know, there we were, we, the United States, 30 years ago. I don't know how many of you remember the Cuyahoga River catching fire. We've been there. We've had horribly contaminated rivers, and that led to legislation and enforcement and policy action, and it led to a lot of the environmental movement here in the United States when highly public water problems appeared. And so I think there was a little bit of a sense of deja vu. The second issue, what do we do about it? What are the paths for solutions? The traditional approach to water solutions has been build more dams, build more aqueducts, build more groundwater wells, build more pipelines, transfer more water from water-rich areas to water-poor areas, the hard path, as Amory would say, for energy, Amory Levins. That solution, those sets of supply-side solutions, brought us enormous benefits here in the United States, and the Chinese have been very aggressive at pursuing concrete, physical infrastructure solutions. But those solutions are not going to be enough. Those solutions are not going to solve the water problems that we have. They're going to be a component, but we're also going to have to look at improving efficiency and water reuse and smart conjunctive use in surface water and groundwater and different kinds of industry and so on. And in fact, in China, that's what we're beginning to see. The Chinese continue to aggressively pursue very centralized hard path solutions. The Three Gorges Dam on the Yangtze River, the south-north transfer to bring water from the south to the north. But they are also now beginning to pursue efficiency solutions around Beijing. They're beginning to think about reallocation from one sector to another. And so again, I see this sort of schizophrenia about what solutions do we pursue, the old world solutions or new world solutions, just as I see that schizophrenia in California. And so that's the second point. And the last point is water is tied to everything. And so it's not just a resource issue. It's a political issue. It's an economic issue. We see political protests in China over water quality problems, just as we saw them here in the United States. Just as, in fact, we saw them early, just as the Soviet Union was starting to loosen its grip on Eastern Europe, the first political protests were environmental protests because they were a little less threatening to the political powers than protests about openness and democracy and so on. We see a lot of NGOs developing. I think that's a great sign. We see open discussion in China about water issues. There's a very strong connection between water and business. There are businesses that cannot or will not open new factories in China because either the reliability of water is too low or the quality of water is too low, and the expense of cleaning it up before they use it is a problem. And so there's a very deep connection between economic growth and water quality and water availability. And then finally, the issue of civil society. What's the role of civil society versus central society or central politics in China? We have national standards for water quality in the United States, but many water decisions in the United States are going to be made at the local level. We're going to see that same dichotomy, that same kind of debate in China. And I think it's going to be a fascinating one.
Thanks, Peter. And you've touched on a number of themes that I'm sure we're going to want to get to in more depth. Orville?
I think if we believe, as I'm sure most of you do, that the U.S.-China relationship is probably the most important in the world, and if we believe that the global environmental issue is one of the most important, and that the U.S. and China sit four square in the very middle of solving almost any of the global environmental issues that are at hand. And furthermore, if you believe that coal, which is demonstrably true, sits at the very center of China's environmental dilemma, as well as our own here in this country, and furthermore, if you realize, as I'm sure all of you do, that the U.S. and China have both opted out of the Kyoto Protocol, so that we both are hiding behind each other in terms of any sort of international buy-in to any international solution, well, we have a remedy, a recipe here for a very big problem, but some potentially very big payoffs if we can think of some way to cut into this Gordian knot. And I think coal is one of the places that deserves our foremost attention, because in China's case, I think it's about 70% of its energy comes from coal. It's very rich in coal, dirty coal. I took a trip across coal country in Shaanxi province not long ago, and I was just stunned by what I saw. I mean, it was the bleakest landscape, everything related to coal, coal transport, coal stockpiling, cement plants, power plants, fly ash. You never saw the sky. You never get out of Beijing, in effect. This is the heart of the matter. So I would say that if I have to point at one thing in 3 minutes that bears our scrutiny and our powers to, insofar as we have some, to think of a solution, it's got to be the bilateral problem of coal. If that can't be solved, whether it's conventional pollutants or greenhouse gases, it doesn't really matter what the EU does. It doesn't really matter what anybody does. We are going to have a very grave ongoing crisis.
Thanks, Orville. That's a very poignant way of putting the problem. Jiafeng, you're sitting at a critical agency in the Chinese government. It's a small one in comparison with the problem. How do you see, how do both you as a researcher and the SIPA look at this question about the environmental challenges there, and what's your agenda? How are you beginning to approach that problem?
Okay. Maybe you know my boundary is different from yours. According to the schedule, I should involve the festival tomorrow. So it's a last-minute call. And you know, in China, 30 years ago, when we're talking about environmental issues, we say it is special, take place in capitalist country. 20 years ago, and we think environmental issue is technical problems. Today, we think environmental issue is political issue. You know, months ago, the governor of Gansu province, he interviewed by Xinhua News Agency. He said, if our province cannot finish the target, saving energy 20%, then 2005 years till 2010, and reduce 10% pollution compared to 2005, I will lose the job, resign. And who knows how many Chinese political leaders will lose their job 3 years later. But it's very, very important in China. We should save energy and reduce pollution. Just 1 month ago, in China, State Council built a special council. Premier Wen Jiabao is the leader. 24 ministers involved that. The council's name is Saving Energy and Pollution Reduction. They have another name. Another name is State Climate Change Coordinate Council. So it means both of them is looks like a twins. If you do a good job receiving energy, it means use fewer coal and reduce CO2. And it is very, very important. In China, last year, we consumed more than 2.4 billion ton standard of coal. You know, what's the mean? According to our plan, till 2020, per Chinese, GDP is about $3,000. You know, last year, the per GDP per person is about 2,113 about. But we consume almost the coal, you know, similar to 2020. You know, if we cannot save energy, you know, we have no national security, energy security, and environmental security. On the other hand, you know, China government, they issued a lot of new policy regulate environmental issue and energy issues. For example, last year, they passed a new law named Sustainable Energy Act. And this year, they will pass the Circular Economy Act. And in the meantime, they will issue the Saving Energy Amendment. And in the other hand, they will be issued the Water Pollution Control Act Amendment. On the other hand, you know, they issued a lot of policy related tax, investment, finance, you know, so many, you know, things. For example, our government just raised the export tax on some the steel or, you know, the goods. They will consume a lot of energies. Control the goods export. It's good for American government to keep the balance. But on the other hand, it's good for Chinese to change our, you know, economic structures. For example, in China, per GDP, we consume the energy is 10 times than Japanese. It means if we can, you know, make a progress, can get, you know, the level like the Japanese, we will receive a lot of thousand energies. So this is why in China, saving energy and pollution reduction became priority political issues. And, you know, just other speakers talking about the Chinese NGO and the media information transparencies. You know, recently, the China, you know, in my personal experience, the China Environment NGO, they have much open and much friendly circumstance. Or we can say in China, our political climate changed, became much and much greener. And for example, China NGO, they involve a lot of environmental events, like the Yuanmingyuan issues or like the Xiamen, the new manufacturing center. And the Chinese government, they issued some of the new regulations on public hearing on the EIA and information transparency on environmental information. You know, all of them means Chinese government try to improve their governors on environmental channel. Maybe in my mind, I think environmental challenge maybe became one of the good channel for Chinese try to become one of the more democracy countries. Thank you.
That's great, and I want to talk about that political dimension in just a second. David, on the economic side, as Jiafeng said, there's been all these targets for greater energy conservation, reduced GDP energy intensity, which haven't been met, at least in the near term. How do you see it in terms of the economic strategy? Is there Is there a connection between the declaratory policy and what's really happening in the economy? How much are these economic environmental dimensions affecting the economy in terms of foreign direct investment and others, and how is that linkage developing in the Chinese mind?
Right. Well, in this current five-year plan, there's this target to increase energy efficiency by 20%, which is actually a remarkably ambitious target for 5 years. In the first year of the plan, the increase in energy efficiency was only 1%. At that moment, there was an intense debate within the Chinese at a pretty high level. Should they just say flat out, this was not a realistic target, and revise it, or should they stick with the target and really get serious about measures? And my understanding is the premier himself played a pretty important role in deciding to go with the former approach, the latter approach. And so what they, in his speech to the National People's Congress, he pointed out they're sticking to the target and that they didn't meet it in the first year and now they're going to get serious. Now, my own view is that while you want to have different measures, the pricing measure is the most obvious one to use. And given that several people have talked about how the central government doesn't really have that much command and control, the pricing mechanism is the obvious mechanism to use in that situation. So if you just put in a very healthy tax on gasoline, and I would tax the use of coal because it has very negative spillover effects, I think you would get a lot of action in terms of increased energy efficiency. There are other measures as well. I see the seriousness. We now have provinces coming to us, the World Bank. Shandong province has come to us and said, can you help us, desulfurize all the power plants in Shandong province? We've got provinces saying, can you help us develop an energy efficiency plan to meet this target, suggesting that they think that this is a serious target coming down from above. So I think the best hope is to continue with some of the command and control, not give up on it completely, but then I would bring in the pricing mechanism as the obvious thing to do.
Maybe you, David, or Orville, or others could comment on the fact that historically for the leaders in the provinces, the rewards have come from generating economic performance. The way you succeeded in the party, in the government, was producing economic growth. That was the thing that the organization department of the Communist Party looked to for success. Xiaofeng has said now the governor of Gansu is going to get rewarded for doing environment. Do you see those kinds of changes taking place? Orville, you've been an observer of the scene for a long time.
Well, I think there has been a big change, but I think we'd be very foolish not to recognize there is a very grave contradiction between the imperatives of 11% growth rate and all of these good environmental intentions. So, my experience in China is there's some amazing projects happening, some very enlightened government leadership, a lot of discussions, a yeasty civil society, and yet, I would say, by and large, China's falling farther and farther behind as development proceeds at this very elevated rate. Now, one other thing I would say, we are sitting up here talking about China. But for heaven's sakes, it takes two hands clapping to make a sound. And the U.S. isn't exactly an exemplar when it comes to some of the things we've talked about. I mean, look at mercury and coal and all of this. I think there's a marvelous collaborative opportunity here. And I hope we'll have a chance to maybe
Absolutely.
Talk about that a bit. Because I think China, even with all of its experiments, with all of its good intentions, its enlightened leadership at the top, it has an absolutely daunting prospect ahead of it to get on top of any of the issues that we've been discussing.
Bruce, how do you see it? And are you seeing on the local level the same kind of receptivity to the NGOs that we're seeing welcome from the premier and the state Environmental Protection Agency, but are they as able to work on the local level? How do they deal with provincial governors?
I think the openness of the national government, the progressive opening to NGOs, is really, really a hopeful sign, not only for the technical expertise, but for the way in which NGOs engage in the civil society side of this. If I were to pass judgment on the NGO experience in China, it's really about awakening local communities to the possibilities of working on these problems. Now, that said, there's a very delicate line here, and the national government is deeply schizophrenic about NGOs, because in their minds, and not without a lot of reason, they say we appreciate the learning experience, the technical capacity, and the ability to begin interacting with civil society. But there's a slippery slope on which NGOs tend to go from the environment back to Tiananmen Square. That is, civil activism toward the environment starts to spill over into the prohibited areas of political reform. And we've had to walk that line very clearly. And the NGOs who do that, in our experience, have considerable latitude, particularly out in the provinces where, as I suggested earlier, the disconnect between provinces, counties, and towns and the national government is really quite extraordinary. It's the hardest thing for me to internalize, having read and understood the politics of the Cultural Revolution, the Great Leap Forward, the whole idea of an autocratic, at least facially communist society, to get out there in the province and find that there are no effective administrative and legal, quasi-legal process issues at all. So we have found, working particularly along the Yangtze River on water problems, that there's, as long as you stay on the right side of the line, there's a wonderful opportunity and a lot of perception change going on in these civil society issues, which are absolutely essential and which do feed into, in my judgment, what David was talking about, and that is there is some progress at the provincial and community levels, and in my judgment, it is much more a function of civil society demand so far than it is from mandates from Beijing. Because what a provincial governor is looking over his shoulder at Beijing really about is, they may threaten to fire me, but they really won't. And they can't execute me. Well, they can do that for people who cut down forests, but normally they're not going to execute politicians, and they really don't know what's going on. That must change in some basic way. But in the meantime, I think we're doing well to say strengthening civil society within bounds is a fantastically fertile ground for NGOs and for productive interchange at all levels along the lines that Orville has suggested is so necessary.
Orville and Peter. Is that, can that boundary be kept? I mean, Peter, you used the analogy of Central and Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. Clearly, the Chinese leadership have been looking at that experience ever since the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union and saying, not us. So if they see what you see, what is the level of tolerance? How concerned is your sense is that this will go from the helpful civil society providing support to national policy to a threat to the whole regime?
Well, I'm not qualified to answer that. I can't see into, my crystal ball is cloudy when I look at that. I think Bruce's point is right. There's a very fine line, and I think NGOs are wrestling with it, and I think the Chinese government is wrestling with it, and I don't think anybody knows where it's going to go. I do think NGOs are going to play an increasing role, and I don't just mean NGOs, I mean communities. And that's where a lot of the NGOs developed in Eastern Europe first, and that's where they're developing in the water area in China. I would add another component to this, though, that I think is very interesting. Orville said correctly that that China's racing as fast as it can just to keep up. It's growing very rapidly. It's hard to deal with any of these environmental issues with a 5 or 10 or 11 or 20% growth rate. And in part because of that, I find China open to things that I would not have imagined them to be open to. In particular, and I come from I run a nonprofit research organization, but I'm seeing an enormous interest in China in inviting in the private sector to solve some of these problems. For example, in the water area, China says that maybe 40% of its wastewater receives any treatment at all. It's urban wastewater. And frankly, of that 40%, most of it is barely treated. So there's a huge sewage problem. And one of the things China is encouraging is foreign companies to come in and jointly build wastewater treatment plants. They're inviting in foreign capital. They're inviting in technical expertise so that they can spend capital on other things. There's a whole new environment, if you will, for the private sector to come in and participate in ways that I wouldn't have imagined a communist government being so enthusiastic about 10 years ago. And that's a new factor.
Well, you've been observing the Chinese government for a long time. Is there an anxiety, do you think, that the helpful NGOs become the Falun Gong in the near future? Or how much of a threat or an anxiety does this cause the leadership?
Well, let's put it this way. I know of no communist party that welcomes independent organizations. And it is true that there is a lot of NGO activity, particularly in the field of the environment. But it's also interesting to note that there's no legal basis yet. They keep kicking a law forward that would give NGOs a legal status to defend themselves. So now even foundations like the Ford Foundation are thrashed around trying to find some way to register, and sometimes they have to register as businesses. So there's a whole lot of subterfuge and kind of guilefulness. But the reality is that as long as NGOs don't get into trouble, they're left alone and they can do some very good work. But more and more, we are finding that there are demonstrations that are precipitated by environmental issues, by factories that are polluting, by rivers, by people getting their land taken for one thing or another. And this is cause for real concern, because this is one of the areas that the government is absolutely determined not to let get out of control. So that link is one that's worth watching and a potentially disturbing one for the future of civil society.
Jeff Wong, a lot of the conversation has been about the capacity, been sort of commending the central government and the leadership for having some good ideas, but questioning about the capacity of the central government to do that and the problems at the local level. SEPA is a tiny agency compared to the size of the country. What's the strategy? I mean, do you see over the long term a stronger environmental protection agency with more regional offices? How is the governance problem going to go going forward to implement these ideas that the leadership have?
How many people are in SEPA? Tell our audience.
Okay. The good news, you know, in China, the government, they were issued a new NGO regulation. So it's much, you know, flexible and friendly, and it's good for and easier for people if they are interested to set up an NGO. Maybe end of this year, maybe next year. So, and for China EPA, the first question is how many employees there? In EPA building, exactly is about 260 employees. But if you plus some organization work for NGO, like the China Environmental Science Academy or China Environmental Monitoring, totally, maybe no more than 1,000.
How many in EPA, Bruce?
Oh, Lord, I have no idea.
38,000?
That's about right. Yeah, I would say 25.
Yeah. You know, in China, we learn how to set up a good environmental supervision systems. This year, we set up the China EPA regional office in Guangdong area, Jiangsu area, Sichuan area, Dongbei, the northeast area, and in Xi'an, you know, areas. So each regional office, there are about from 30 employees. So, you know, in China, the political structure is different from America. Our legal structure is big different from here too. So the Chinese government, like the EPA, central government, yesterday, the minister, Zhou Shengxian, he gives very strong criticism to the local leader. Say they said the local leader, they take an umbrella, protect the local polluter. It's very interesting. And the Pan Yue said, you know, months ago, China EPA sent a special group to, you know, to invest some the company to see whether they have the pollution things. Then the safeguard of the factory, they say, you cannot entry. They say, we come from Beijing. We are, you know, central government officials. They say, no. You know, according to Chinese environmental law, the factory, the safeguard is right. Because according to the law, China's central EPA, they have no legal right entry the factory. So this is a problem. You know, our Premier Wen Jiabao, President Hu Jintao, our minister, so many political leaders said, we should do that on the pursuing the sustainable development. But why so many environmental accidents today? Every 2 or 3 days, you know? Why? Cannot control. One of the reasons is we should spend more time, more resources to issue new law. You know, or today, the government, they like to do some administration tools. Don't use the Congress, don't use the law. You know, for example, if if the factory lets the water pollution out from the pipe of the end of the pipe, so they will be charged according to pollution pay principles. And you know how much they pay? They pay about per ton dirty water about 0.6 RMB. But if the factory establish a treatment facilities and emit the standard dirty water according to the law, legal way, they will be spent about at least 0.8 RMB per ton. What's the problem? The law is a problem. But, you know, everybody know if you want to draft a new law or make the law become a legislation, you should spend the time. Yes, everything you should spend the time. Especially if you are the government want to be a legal and do the role of the law. So you have to, this is cost. But today, we try to do the, you know, environmental supervise in a different way. Maybe, next year or the year after next year, the new environmental law will be issued. So, but we try to, you know, we wish the legal, you know, something, the progress in the futures. And on the other issues, if I have time,
please.
I want to say, you know, in China, reduce pollution and saving energy is a great, maybe is one of the biggest opportunity for China to the future. In the meantime, it's a great opportunity for the world to the future. One of the reasons, you know, Maurice Strong, the former Undersecretary of the UN, and he come to my lectures, give our students a key keynote speech. He said, sustainable development is not an option for China. No option for China. Only way, you know, if China cannot succeed and other world, including America, successful, you know, is lost. But if China can, you know, take a sustainable road, it means no any country have the, you know, the rescues cannot do sustainable way. I just came here yesterday from Sweden, from a Talberg Forum. It is another, you know, think tank event like today here. So there, so many Swedish people, EU people, you know, African people talking about China opportunities. Then, before I left, I have the short meeting with Global Forum there. The Global Forum is a very young organization. It's a young guy, no more than 30 years old. They have billion US dollars. And they want to do some of the environmental investment in China. Because China have much stronger needs drive to the sustainable development. You know, California state government, they just established an energy saving office in Beijing. So it's good, it means if you find the opportunities, not only make money, but also it's good for our future.
Thank you, and that I do want to get to the audience, but I would like to have our panel turn to this sort of as the final part of our discussion, which is, as we've heard from so many of you, what's happening in China has an impact on all of us, whether it's Russia with the pollutants coming down through the Songhua, whether it's climate change, which affects us all, whether it's acid rain that's affecting all of Northeast Asia. And so there is a big stake in the success. Indeed, China's economic success obviously matters to us all. So what should others be doing? What is the United States pursuing good policies, the international community, international organizations, the bank, others? What is the role of others in helping China address these problems? David, do you want to start?
Yeah, I mean, I think the world has a huge stake in helping China succeed with these issues because it's going to have a big effect on the whole world. Frankly, in the World Bank now, more than 70% of all the activities we do in China are directly aimed at environmental issues. So I do think that's one small contribution. But I do think the rich countries, it's very much in their interest to subsidize China to introduce different types of cleaner, and more environmental friendly technologies. You know, for example, you mentioned Shaanxi. In the coal mining area of China, not only is it the coal mining area where they have a lot of these mining disasters, but it also a lot of methane is emitted from those mines, and it's a deadly greenhouse gas, causes a lot of mine disasters. It's emitted into the atmosphere. The U.S. and Australia have very good technology for taking the coal bed methane, turning it into liquefied natural gas, which is a clean source, so you can make the mine safer, reduce the greenhouse gas emissions, develop a clean source. And it actually may even be able to do it commercially, but the first few projects, it may not really be strictly commercial, or seeing a private firm take on that risk in China's regulatory environment is probably not practical. So this is an obvious area. If the U.S. and Australia jumped in with some significant subsidy, you know, you could probably develop the use of coal mine methane in China. There are lots of examples. You know, I could talk for hours about lots of specific examples of technologies that it would be in the world's interest to have introduced into China. And it may just take initially some minor subsidy coming from the rich countries. We have a little bit of this now because we have the Global Environment Facility. And then if I could make one small correction, Orville, China did sign the Kyoto Protocol.
Yes, they're not,
as a developing country, right. As a developing country, they don't have any commitment, but they are the largest seller of emission reduction. So a lot of the interesting stuff happening in China now is packaging commercial investment together with selling emission reductions in the global market. So China's basically selling more than $1 billion a year of emission reductions, and that is supporting things like wind power stations, reduction of methane from landfills, lots of potentially good things. I'm worried that after 2012, that whole global market goes away because we don't have any post-Kyoto regime. So I think for the U.S. to take the lead together with the Europeans and Japanese in developing the post-Kyoto regime, that's really going to be critical. And it will take an effort. I think China's reached a point where the world is going to expect China not just to sell emission reductions, it's going to expect China to make some commitments. That will be tough political dialogue. But if the U.S. doesn't take the lead in making commitments, then there's no hope in having that tough political discussion.
Peter, what could others be doing to make a difference in helping?
Well, I agree with David's comments about technology. I would add that, of course, these are not just technological issues. They're institutional issues. They're legal issues. They're economic issues. And so there needs to be a sharing of all of those things, of experience learned, of success stories. There's a time problem here. We took a long time in the United States to deal with our environmental issues. And, of course, we haven't finished, needless to say. But China can't take as long, in part because the issue of climate change is such a big one, in part because the water issue is so critical already to sustainable development. They're not going to develop as fast because they're already up against their limits on water. And so the things that we know how to do, we have to do faster. There has to be more technological exchange and development more quickly. There have to be lessons exchanged more quickly on institutions and on laws. There are things that we've learned here that I think could be applied in China, but we also have to be careful about thinking, well, look, we did it here, let's do it in China, and without any understanding of the cultural and institutional and historical and political differences, which makes some things not appropriate. And so that's a problem. And finally, I just agree completely, we're all in this mess together. The day when environmental issues were local air quality issues or local water quality issues alone are over. We're now faced with those issues as well as these comprehensive global environmental issues. Of course, climate change being perhaps the most significant, but not the only one. And so what happens here affects China. What happens in China affects the rest of the world as well. And so we really are looking for a global regime for some of these challenges.
Bruce, you've seen it both from the government and the NGO side. What's the outside world?
Jim, lamentably, I think there's a case to be made that in our administration, in this country, with its emphasis on unilateralism, with confrontational politics, that the best American policy toward China in the last 7 years has been neglect. Now, there are a few exceptions to that. Hank Paulson, as Secretary of the Treasury, has done quite an extraordinary job in his little corner of enlightened engagement with China. We need to move toward drawing China as quickly as we possibly can into multilateral venues of all kinds. China should and must become a member of the G8. When we have enlightened, hopefully soon, leadership in this country, the possibilities for governmental engagement in a multilateral world are just incredible and terribly important. Lastly, I would say that Americans at all levels, even in the absence of their government, should look for ways to engage personally and in all of their civil society groups with their counterparts in China. The most extraordinary thing I found in China is its openness and interest in Americans. We could talk about that for another hour, but it's a fact. Americans are welcome in China at all levels. And for all of the failures of the past, that's something that we can work on at all levels and something we should.
Orville, any thoughts on this before we go to the audience?
I think we're all on the same page. I think we're waiting for America to help lead with China a way out of this darkness. And I think the challenge now is to get some major initiatives that involve capital and investment, technology and management, and we should form a triangle of the U.S. and Japan. Japan's cleaned up its environment very well. It's very eager to show sort of friendly gestures towards China. And I think we need to have something that is incubated over the next year and rolled out when, as Bruce said, when there's a change in Washington. Before that, I'm afraid the U.S. is not going to lead anywhere.
Great. Well, let's now turn to the audience. I don't know whether we have mics or not, but we do. We have mics. Great. So if you could just raise your hand, and I think the mics will come to you. And are they on the sides? Okay. I don't see them, but probably you all do. So. Please come to the mics and. There we go, right over here, please.
I'm Chet Tezeski with the Global Green Grants Fund. We're based in Boulder, but we make environmental grants to grassroots environmental groups in developing countries. We've been making grants in China since about 1995. We make about 100 grants a year. Almost all of them are under $5,000. In fact, most of them are under $1,000. And most of them are outside of Beijing. So obviously what I want to talk about is the importance you've all placed on civil society and what you've all called NGOs, but which I know you all know are not really independent non-governmental organizations. They're what we call GONGOs, government-organized non-governmental organizations. So what I'd like to know is what you see as the prospects for an emergence of a truly independent civil society, especially at the community level. And if it emerges, how will it be financed independently? of both the government and business interests so that it can serve, as it does in much of the rest of the developed world, as a third leg on a chair to provide stability and counterbalance. My second question, unrelated to the first, is about China's role in the world, in the environment, in the rest of the world, as they begin to invest and import natural resources from other parts of the world, particularly Africa. Will the green ethics that are emerging in China travel with them? Because, as we also know, when they ended logging in China, they didn't stop using timber products. They just started importing them from Russia. And will that happen with the other natural resources that they're now extracting around the world?
Terrific questions. Orville, on the NGO side, do you have any thoughts about the prospect and what sources, you know, might sustain these organizations to become truly independent?
Well, we're looking at something of a Petri dish. Experiment between this independent part of society and the party structure. And one of the most contentious issues is, of course, funding. And should these NGOs be able to accept funding from the outside world? And there are many ways that this actually does happen. But they're not. It's not easy. And I must say there is a kind of a bias against outside funding. So I don't know the answer to that. This is going to be something that needs to be watched very carefully.
Orville, let me just interject. We have actually precisely the opposite problem. WWF is not allowed to take contributions from Chinese citizens. The only funding we get is from outside China. Now, my question to Professor Feng is, there's some speculation that this may change in the new NGO regulations. I hope you will be a vigorous advocate for that change.
You know, Woodrow Wilson Center, CORAS, Center for Environmental Education and Communication, is environmental gango. One of the reasons is, before 2004, per year, you know, the government financial support is about 16%, maybe sometimes lower. Most of our budget comes from international organization, World Bank, or some private sectors. Most of them outside China. So recent, you know, today, you know, I just mentioned in China, there is not the NGO history. And there is no tradition Chinese government provide financial support to NGO. But today, this will change because the government said we have more and more, you know, money, we want to buy the public service from NGO. So today, the NGO, not only the gango, but also the real NGO, they can, you know, send application from two relative government agencies get some financial support. So I think it is a little bit changed.
David, do you have any insight on the foreign policy question, the development strategy of China?
Yeah, so just very quickly on the second question, China is becoming a major investor and even a donor in the rest of the developing world, especially in Africa. The Chinese position is that their companies should follow local environmental regulations. You know, that has a certain logic to it. The problem is many developing countries have quite weak, either don't have very good environmental policies in place or they have nice policies on paper, but they're not enforced in practice. So my own view on this is I think it's useful for the world to kind of address these issues in two ways, both what you might think of as top-down and bottom-up. You know, I think the bottom-up is very important. So I think everywhere in the world, civil society plays a very important disciplining role in trying to get good environmental outcomes. So I think we should encourage, you know, African civil society. They should keep an eye on World Bank investment. They should keep an eye on China investment. They should keep an eye on American investment. I think that's very important. The top-down side, one small thing we're doing is the World Bank has entered into a partnership with China Exim Bank, which will be executing their concessional loan program, and we're going to try to work together in selected African and Asian countries and see if we can co-finance projects, all of which would have to follow World Bank environmental and social and financial safeguards, and our private sector wing is trying to do the same thing with Chinese investors that are making direct investments into Africa. And I hope within a short time we'll have some very successful examples of where Chinese finance and Chinese expertise has produced a very good result, you know, in Ghana, or I'm trying to do this in Mongolia, where I'm also country director. And so I hope that we can show a positive lesson that Chinese investment and foreign assistance can provide benefits with sound environmental and social policies.
Please.
In China, you know, the social, the corporate social responsibility report is more and more popular. Last December, Aspen Institute, they worked together with us, initiated a new program. We developed the CSR education in China Business School. And 7 years ago, similar program, we worked together with WRI on green MBA programs. You know, since 2004, every year, our center provide training to about 30 to 60 African environmental officials. They will spend about 3 weeks in Beijing and in other Chinese cities. Chinese government provide all the cost, including, you know, transport, the air tickets, and all the other cost. So it means, in the meantime, we provide training to the government, environmental government officials who come from Middle Asia areas. So it is, we try to do some things, but we should learn a lot from other developed country. Like, you know, World Bank, they work together with us to do the community dialogue program in the very lower, you know, level. So this program is very good for Chinese community to dialogue between different environmental stakeholders. So I think it's one of the way to make, you know, China environmental governor is become a good.
Great, that's terrific. I think there's somebody standing under the lights there.
David Vernon, just a quick question. I guess I would see many of the environmental problems that China's facing as a byproduct, if you will, of export manufacturing activity over the past 10, 15 years. And I guess I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts on trade or regulatory controls that could be put in place between the developing nations and their sourcing partners in China specifically.
David?
Yeah, I never really answered a parallel question from Jim and Orville, which relates to this. So, you know, I agree with the thrust of one of Orville's points that this 11% growth rate, you know, that by itself is something of a problem in terms of environmental damage. But I think it's more the nature of the growth rather than the growth rate itself. You know, I think China can grow quite rapidly and address these environmental issues. But as long as there's such a tremendous export orientation to the growth, and given that what China tends to export now is pretty capital and energy intensive, I think the mode of growth is a real problem for China meeting its own environmental targets, and it's a problem for the world. So frankly, I think there's an obvious policy package for China to raise prices of energy and water, allow the exchange rate to appreciate, which would tend to reduce the export push, and then they could put a lot more money into social programs, into rural development, and they could sustain the growth of the economy by meeting domestic needs. So I think they could grow, probably not at 11%, but their own target is 8%. They can definitely grow at 8%, meet these environmental targets, and then implicitly and explicitly, they would be taking the pressure off this tremendous export push, which I no longer think is in the country's interest.
Peter, did you want to?
Yeah, I'd like to add a factor, which I think is relevant to this question and the last question we got, and that is, in the last month or so, there's been a lot of news in U.S. newspapers about contamination in Chinese products, bad quality goods, lead in children's toys. That's partly a result of the failure of the Chinese government to regulate quality. It's partly a result of this export push that's been growing so rapidly over the last couple of decades. And the good news in it, if there's any good news, is that as China becomes part of the world economy, an increasing part of the world economy, as corporate social responsibility becomes an important part of corporate behavior, we're going to see, I hope, more international level constraints on quality, on what ultimately will be, I think, environmental improvements. We're going to have to see corporations not meet
the local environmental standards in the companies they operate, because we know that those standards often are terrible, but some international standard or some corporate standard that is a higher level than the country's standard in which they operate in Africa or parts of Asia that we see today. So we're going to see a move, I believe, toward corporate social responsibility that requires higher standards, that requires more transparency, that ultimately will feed back to environmental improvements. And I hope that that's good news. I don't know if it's going to be, but I think it will be.
Bruce?
Jim, just two quick examples of that. Walmart, go to their website and take a look at their corporate environmental policies, including procurement, which they do all over the world. It is a stunning document, which is going to have reach and impact all over this world. Second, on the resource issue, the other nations of the world have a lot of say about how this goes on. A good example is IKEA. The furniture, much of the furniture you buy is made in China. IKEA has agreed to the forest certification standards, which means that the wood that they get as raw materials in China must be traced back to its origin, whether in Africa or Burma or wherever, from forests which meet certified standards. Both of those, I think, suggest the extraordinary possibility in a world which is awakening to its respective responsibilities in the global marketplace.
I think big companies with global brands can't afford not to be on the cutting edge of this, and they're also discovering it's a pretty good market to get green. So I think it's the little operators, you know, with the amortize a factory over 5 years and then they're gone. These are the troublemakers.
I see two more people out there. What I'm going to do is I'd like to take both of the questions and then we'll have the panel answer them so we can wrap up close to on time. So why don't you start over here?
It's John Anda. I'm with Environmental Defense. I have a question for Bruce Babbitt about our political will in this area and specifically in greenhouse gases. David Dollar made a comment this morning that he thought, you know, the way to cap CO2 emissions is to give everybody in the world, every citizen, their own budget. Well, Bruce, I want to ask you a specific question on David Dollar's idea. 20 tons for every American, less than 3 for every Chinese. In order to get something done, maybe over the next 40 years, we have to go to 5 tons ourselves, let's say, cut 3/4 of our tonnage. But in order to do that, you know, we're probably going to have to let China go up from 3 tons to 5 tons. Bruce Babbitt, what I wonder is the political will and the ability to explain to our policymakers that, A, we have to go first, and, B, that we have to let some rise happen to China, which is a lot poorer and uses a lot less energy or emits a lot less CO2 than we do per person.
And over here, please.
Hi. My name is Lily Friedland, and I have a question that I'd like some clarification on. It sounds like China's using largely foreign investment to help them environmentally, and yet they're willing to go to other countries, other less developed nations, and do the same. How about them taking responsibility for the environmental work that needs to be done? Because they, this way, get all the work done by other developed countries, and yet get all the positive press and things that accrue to them, including an in on getting the raw materials by going to these less developed countries and getting credit for what we're doing for them.
Bruce, do you want to prognosticate what's possible in the U.S. political system?
Notwithstanding the sharply honed specificity of that question directed at a fellow NGO, here's my reading of what this is about. China has, I believe, been quite forthcoming about the climate change issue. The statement issued in June by Minister Ma, have I got that right?
Kai.
Uses the phrase common but differentiated responsibilities. But that reflects, in my judgment, a statement by the Chinese government that we are willing and ready to engage. We expect that there will be differential compliance targets which reflect the inequalities that the questioner is talking about, that China has historically not been responsible for the lion's share of what's up there in the atmosphere right now, that on a per capita basis, their carbon output is about 20% of ours, and that there must be some differentiation of responsibilities, as indeed there were in the Montreal Protocol, which dealt successfully with the ozone question. So I read China as simply saying, you can't possibly expect us to negotiate against ourselves. We've said we're ready to begin. The difficulty, of course, is that the United States is hiding behind China rather than leading. All I can say about that is we have lots of examples of how these multilateral arrangements can be worked, including the Montreal Protocol. I think it's incumbent upon every American to focus intensely upon the year 2008, particularly the second Tuesday in November.
Before 2000, in the past 100 years, 77% CO2 emissioned by developed country. And before 1950, more than 85%. It is why international convention set up an international legal principle, common but different responsibilities. On the other hand, you know, China, the G8 and other countries, they try to ask Chinese government set up a CO2 emission target. But in China, you know, we just issue a national report, but we haven't set up this target. But it's not mean. Chinese don't want to reduce CO2 emission. For example, all roads lead to Roma. And for a developed country, you can, you know, reduce CO2 at the end of the pipe, store the CO2 in China. They saving energy during the manufacture process to reduce CO2. So both of them, you know, finally, they will be good for, you know, stop the climate change.
And before we finish, any comment on this idea of China taking a kind of more central role in managing the environmental responsibilities?
Yeah, I might not have been clear about some of the things I've said. I do think, you know, China is using various international technologies to help address water issues and energy issues. Most of those it's paying for commercially. So frankly, the environment is very good business for a whole bunch of companies from Northern Europe, the United States, Canada, Japan, and you know, China doesn't really receive any significant amount of foreign aid. The World Bank lending to China is all at commercial terms, and it gets a small amount of subsidy from the Global Environment Facility, but there's not a lot of sympathy around the world for helping China at the moment. So I think what a number of us were suggesting is that because many of these environmental issues have global impact, it really would make more sense to come up with larger subsidies, essentially, to help China, particularly in the climate change area, where the impact is definitely global. I take your point that as China invests heavily in Africa and other parts of the world where there are a lot of resources, you know, the world has an interest, you know, in looking at what kind of environmental standards are being pursued. And I already mentioned that I think the key to that is strengthening the capacity of developing countries, including the civil society element there. It's a nice thought that there'd be a global regime that would, you know, manage this, but I think that's not realistic to have a global environmental protection agency that's actually reaching down to the local level in Ghana and investigating what's happening. I'm much more hopeful that we can build up civil society in different parts of the world to keep an eye on these things than I am that there'll be some kind of global administration.
David, just a quick footnote to what you said. It's worth noting as we contemplate the prospect of the developed nations helping to subsidize the diminishing carbon in the atmosphere, that China is now become the dumping ground for all of the things we use. They are the manufacturing industrial part. We have exported not only a lot of money, we've exported all the pollution to China. So in that sense, if we're shopping in Walmart, we might meditate a moment on, you know, what kind of pollution.
Polluter industry line to China. You know, your government, the Congress, just issued a regulation, control some of the high technology to China. Maybe you should issue a national regulation, control these kind of things, export to China.
Well, it's a wonderful note to end on, and I particularly like Orville's notion of us all going to Walmart and meditating a little bit in the aisles. I want to thank the panelists, but particularly Jiafeng, who pitched in at the last moment and made an extraordinary contribution, but to all the terrific panelists and the audience for your very good questions, thanks very much.